The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
You are looking at me. And I feel a little bit funny sitting here. I was thinking of giving a talk, but as I'm sitting here, do I really want to give a talk? And do you really want me to give a talk? I suppose I could try giving a talk. That's what I usually do here. Any other ideas? No other ideas? So what I had, I'll talk about what I was thinking of talking about. And I thought of going a little bit back to basics in the practice of mindfulness. And, you know, in some ways the most basic thing about mindfulness practice is the mindfulness itself. And if you listen to the most basic teachings, it could be something like, be mindful of what's happening in the present moment. And so you sit down to try to do that, in meditation perhaps. And then your life is happy ever after, right? You sit down and you're mindful and it just, everything unfolds, right? No. What happens is that you sit down to be mindful and much of the time you're not. I think. If you're like me. And so one of the really important areas of understanding, of practice, of attention in mindfulness practice is not mindfulness itself, but rather is what takes you away from being mindful. The forces in the mind that make you distracted or make it hard to be present in a useful way. The forces in the mind that make you agitated or preoccupied or get you caught up in things. And the tradition, in our mindfulness tradition, one of the most basic lists of mental forces that get us caught up is called, usually called in English, the hindrances. And the Pali word for the hindrances, nivarana, literally means to cover over, to cover up. And I like this idea of the five coverings rather than the five hindrances. I mean, they do hinder us, but I think of them also as not just hindering us, but they also cover over. They cover over our wisdom, our wise understanding. They cover over our insight, our ability to see well what's going on. And they cover over our freedom. Because when we're in the grip of what's these things called the hindrances, there's no freedom. And one of the most remarkable, I think, or perhaps underappreciated moments in the practice of Buddhism or mindfulness or freedom is the very simple, seemingly, it's easy to talk about, experience that hopefully you've all had at some point in your life of feeling yourself about to get caught in some activity, like you're about to get angry or about to be greedy or about to kind of get caught up in something. And you say, well, I don't have to do that. No, I won't do that. Not this time. Not now. And that movement, it can be very little movement of choosing, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to stay free. Maybe you don't think in those terms, but it's not in my favor to go get involved. And so there's this release, or this letting go, or this not picking up. And the mind stays uncaught by that particular thing. And probably if you search in your memories, there have probably been situations, maybe small situations in your life, where you've had that movement, where you step back and say, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to perpetuate this. I'm not going to get caught up in that. I'm going to not get worked up about this. No. And much of the path of Buddhism is these movements, these moments of this, no, I'm going to be free, not going to be caught. And then trying to learn how to develop that capacity to stay free, how to have a more and more higher quality of freedom or of release or not, uncaught upness. And so part of the process of learning that is to understand how we get caught, how we get caught up. And these five hindrances, there are five ways that this happens. It's not meant to be, I don't think it's meant to be exhaustive of all the possible ways you can get caught up. But it's every retreat that we teach, pretty much, almost every retreat, there's someone who gives a talk on the five hindrances because they're so important. So these five hindrances are, there's really seven, but some of them are categorized together. So there's sensual desire. Sometimes people just call it desire, but in a classic list, it's sensual desire. And the second one is ill will. Sometimes it's translated into English as aversion. And the third is sloth and torpor. So these are where you have two things in one category. Sloth and torpor. I don't know how many times you use sloth in your vocabulary. But for some reason, maybe because the Buddhist texts were first translated into English in Victorian English times, that maybe that was a popular word back then, sloth. So I don't think it was ever in my active vocabulary until I became a Vipassana student. Sloth. So sloth and torpor. And then the fourth category is, sloth and torpor are kind of like sinking mind. The mind gets dull. The next one is mind gets over-agitated. So this is usually called restlessness and remorse. Restlessness and regret, the kind of restlessness that can come from being caught up in remorse or regret. And then the fifth one is doubt. And these can be extremely powerful forces in the mind, and they can be very subtle. One of the things that's useful, I think, for many people to understand is that these five activities of the mind are fairly universal in human beings. So it's helpful not to take it too personally, not to take it as, you know, that it's a personal failing, that you're the first person on the planet who's been caught up in the grips of desire or anger or doubt. And, you know, how embarrassing. You're supposed to be, you know, the practice was to sit down, be mindful, and be happy ever after, and it didn't work that way, and you must be a Buddhist failure. The more useful approach is to, when you encounter one of these, is in a very wise way, meaning encountering yourself, in a very wise way, you tell yourself, great. This is great. And not that it's wonderful that you go around, you know, addicted to something, but rather this is great because now you get to study it. You get to discover what it is. You get to understand it better. So I think it's really helpful in this practice of mindfulness not to be upset by what comes up in your mind. Don't be aversive to it, or don't judge yourself because of it. But it's, you know, it's almost as a corrective to that, it's better to kind of do almost like the opposite, like say, great. Okay. Not great, like, okay, let's just go ahead and barrel away with my aversion, ill will. But rather, great, now I get to study this and learn something which is universal. It's a human characteristic that I share with everybody else. Maybe at this particular moment I have more than the people around me. But still, I share it with, and this is one of the tasks we have, is to understand our humanity, not just for our own sake, but for other people as well. And so to be a certain kind of a welcoming. And in this kind of welcoming way, you're actually helping to support, reinforce the movement towards being mindful, which would be, okay, now that I have a strong desire in my mind, let me be mindful of it. Let me be mindful of my restlessness. Let me be mindful of my doubt. And that movement to be curious, that movement to investigate and look at, is a very powerful movement, because it's kind of like the opposite of being caught in something. It's kind of like stepping back, or kind of like releasing yourself a little bit in order to look at something rather than be it. So it's possible to kind of almost become your anger and be swept into it. But when you get curious and step back and say, what is this? A part of you, maybe not a big part, but a part of you is not caught. And what we want to do is reinforce that part of us that can be not caught so they can grow. And so we become more free. And as we become more free, there becomes this uncovering process. Remember, the hindrance is cover. And we uncover greater depths of wisdom, of creativity, of warmth, of love, of compassion. You know, many of the beautiful qualities of heart that are often not available when we're in the grips of these five hindrances. So a very important part of this practice of mindfulness is to turn towards them when they arise. And I'll talk more about that. So the first is desire, specifically sensual desire. So the kind of desire for sensual pleasure that is pretty common in the human realm. Some people have it more than others for some reason. Some people, it's extremely powerful. Some people, it takes over their lives. Not only does it take over their life, but it destroys their lives because it's so powerful. I talked to a person recently who was deeply troubled. This is a person who'd done a lot of meditation practice of a certain kind. And I was deeply troubled because he got pulled into the world of internet pornography. And he spent a whole day on it, doing it. And it took me 3 days to recover. And he said, this was the opposite. My state of the mind was the opposite of jhana. he got into such a kind of, unsettled, agitated state of mind from doing it. But that, it was an example of someone who got pulled in by his desire, by sensual desire. And so there's lots of examples of people in our society who get pulled into the world somehow or other, one way or the other, their mind craves or wants. In meditation practice, it can take many different forms. One is that the mind can start thinking about something that has nothing to do with the meditation at all, but it goes down into the world of fantasy, and those fantasies, if you study them, would see clearly they are in the realm of sensual desire. So, for example, sexual fantasies that are so easy for some people to happen, and you can spend the whole 45 minutes involved in a sexual fantasy. And, this involves a sensual desire. There's no meditation going on, perhaps. And I've known people on retreat who, and they didn't tell me they were sexual fantasies, but on retreat who said, I've been meditating for several days on retreat, and my knees hurt, and I worked really hard, and I felt like I deserved a break. So I just went off into my fantasy, thinking about some wonderful desire, vacation someplace in the beach or something. And, it was kind of an escape. There can be all kinds of desires. I spent a year of my life caught up in the desire and all the fantasies and all the pleasure and all the status and all the wonderful accolades I was going to get. When I was going to fantasizing how I was going to be assigned to be the head cook in the monastery, and I was really shocked because I was clearly the most qualified person, and when the time came to assign the jobs at the monastery for that period of time, I wasn't assigned to the kitchen, but I spent a year of my life fantasizing about how wonderful it was. I was planning menus and recipes and the whole thing. And so I was caught up in, you know, some of that, you know, was kind of being caught up in desire and the allure of desire and the sensuality of desire and the promise of desire. And, you know, my mind just kind of went there so strongly. And it's so easy to be caught in that allure. And some of it sometimes comes from loneliness or comes from insecurity or comes from feeling empty in some way, that desire is a way to try to fill that. And so the part of the power of the desire is to fill a want that we have. And I'm kind of fond of the idea that, you know, desire and want are almost mean the same thing. But sometimes in English, we use the word want occasionally in this peculiar way where we say, like, the soup wants salt. Some of you hear that kind of expression? Meaning that kind of meaning it lacks salt. So it kind of, salt would make it fulfilled. So sometimes I think this idea of, you know, that we, you know, there's this lack we have, and so we try to fill it. We feel uncomfortable or something. So one of the tasks of mindfulness is not only to study the movement of desire and how it functions for us, but also to understand and look at what drives the desire, what's behind it, what is it covering over. And sometimes what these hindrances cover is our inability to be present for our discomfort. What it covers over is how our discomforts trigger these different strategies in order to kind of cope with that or compensate for that or something. And so it's very powerful to sit down in meditation, for example, and when there's strong desire that arises, to sit still and see and feel your way into what it might be covering, what's this deeper kind of movement might be. I found it very useful to consider that the hindrances can be seen as five strategies, unhelpful strategies we have when we're challenged. When we're challenged something that's uncomfortable, then different people, different times, you know, we kind of unhealthy coping strategies. And sometimes the strategy is desire, fantasies and wanting something, compensation or whatever. Sometimes the strategy is aversion, attack, destroy, blame, push away. So that's the second hindrance. One, the first hindrance is more about wanting something. The second is to push it away or not want it. So aversion. It's said that there are some people are characterized as being more desire types. Some people are more aversion types. So for example, for me, I've recognized after many years of knowing myself that I tend to be more of a desire type. I tend to go into that direction if I'm going to go in directions. I want something. Other people are more an aversive type, and that's where they fall into. And again, it's important not to take it too personally, but to just that's the way it kind of sometimes kind of works. It's interesting that in the Buddhist tradition, at least I call it Buddhist lore, so I don't know if we take this too seriously, but I think it's kind of interesting. There's a kind of a lore in Buddhism that it's a little bit better to be an aversive type than a desire type. and for the purposes of practice, you can cause more damage in the world being an aversive type than a desire type, they say. However, aversive type being aversive can be a little more helpful for practice of meditation or practice of Buddhism, because you can more strongly say no. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let go of that. And that was supposed to be a little bit reassuring for the aversive types out there. So sometimes you sit in meditation and what arises is not desire, but arises aversion. So it can also take the form of fantasy, daydreaming about something, thinking about some irritant you have in your life, some challenge you have, and fuming about it. Or it can be about what's happening here and now. It could be that the meditation is uncomfortable, or your mind is uncomfortable in some way. And so the gut reaction to that is somehow or other to want to push it away, get rid of it, squash it, destroy it, zap it away, or to attack something, blame something. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's ourselves. I'm terrible, I'm bad. And so, the fact that I'm uncomfortable must mean that, you know, someone has to take responsibility and of course I'm the person. So, or sometimes it's, you know, the aversion goes outwards. I'm uncomfortable, and it's the person who's keeps taking on and off his Velcro jacket. You know, that's, you know, is to blame, or, you know, that's, you know, you, we find and choose. We find something in the environment that will kind of conveniently take the brunt of our need to be aversive. And because we feel uncomfortable, something has to take it. So both with desire and aversion, they're so common, such a common phenomena. They both have objects. Generally, they have objects that they're concerned with. If we have desire, we have desire for something. And so if we have aversion, we are aversive towards something. If the the tendency is that because we're focusing on an object, a concern, a preoccupation, the mind is looking at that and thinking about it, involved in it. And so because of that, we lose ourselves. And the more powerful the aversion or desire is, the more we lose touch with ourselves, because the more we're focusing on the object, the thing we're concerned about. So the movement of mindfulness, if you have enough presence of mind to do this, is to take your attention and turn it around 180 degrees. Stop looking at the object of what you want, and look and feel, pay attention to what it feels like to be desiring. What does it feel like to be aversing, to be have ill will, to be hostile, to have aversion? So we're not necessarily stopping having desire or aversion. Which, you know, if you let go of it too quickly, maybe you don't really learn what it is. So you want to be careful not to let go of things too quickly. But by turning around 180 degrees, then you have a chance to feel what it's like subjectively for you to have desires going on or have anger going on. And it's very revealing to pay attention to the subjective cost or effect that it has on you when you're doing it. One of the things that happens for a fair number of people have talked to me is that who have a lot of anger, at some point if you become aware of the cost that anger has on you, rather than keeping focusing on the person you're angry with, you know, this is not worth it. The cost-benefit analysis doesn't add up. And so, you know, this is too expensive, this is too hard, this is too much stress on this system here. And so there's sometimes an easier tendency to let go. Say, no, I don't need to do this. Same thing with desire. And, you know, it's interesting, again, to be on retreat. And because on retreat, one of the things that can happen on longer meditation retreats that are in multiple days is that tendencies in our mind that we do in daily life, we do in an interrupted way, oftentimes. And we get distracted, and we have to go do this, and we have to go shopping, and we have to cook dinner, and we have to go to work. And so, you know, it's kind of all broken up in a certain kind of way. On retreat, there's very little to break it up. And so a certain powerful habits of mind that we have, there's more time to do it. And so after a while, people get sick and tired of it. And so I've had desire, you know, fantasies of a variety of different types on retreat, and I couldn't let go of it easily. It just went on and on until finally that this, you know, it was pretty fun and alluring at first, but then after a while, it's tiring and boring and flat, and so the subjective feeling of it is just, this doesn't do anything for me anymore. So this movement of turning around and feeling subjectively what's going on. It's also part of this movement of curiosity or interest or looking that I talked about earlier that begins the process of freeing yourself, of releasing yourself from the grip and the allure of what's going on. So sometimes for some people it works well to turn around and really feel what's going on here. Sometimes that turning around and looking is counterindicated, because sometimes turning around and being present for the subjective experience can re-trigger even more of the same material. Because if we're incapable of being present for our discomfort, and by turning around and feeling how uncomfortable it is to feel this way, then it can trigger more kind of agitation, more desire, more aversion. So then something else is needed. And so then sometimes the Buddhist tradition offers antidote practices to offer something different that kind of breaks the trance or breaks the enchantment we have with these things. And with aversion, when we're caught in the grip of aversion and anger, and it doesn't really work to turn around and look at it carefully, the tradition offers the practice of loving kindness. For a strong desire, there's a variety of different things that are considered antidotes for that. One of them is to use your imagination in a variety of different ways creatively to see if your imagination can kind of show you how undesirable it is to keep pursuing that kind of desire. So if it's sexual desire, the tradition says maybe you can imagine the person with that you have the desire for with their skin peeled off. You know, what would that be like then? You know, and then just imagine that you do your best, you know. And you can appreciate that the skin is really nice and beautiful, but you hang it up next to, you know, in the coat rack, and you get into, you know, what's just underneath the skin. And not to be dismissive of the beauty of the human body, but because you really need help. Because you're caught in the way that you don't, you know, there's enough of this. And then when I was in the Zen monastery in Japan, I wasn't told this officially, but I was told unofficially that one of the techniques they had there for helping the young monks deal with their desire was to, some certain kinds of desire, was to overindulge it. So make them sick. And so apparently, I wasn't part of this kind of thing, but I was told sometimes they would take the young monks and climb over the wall in the middle of the night, sneak out, I guess, with the head monks leading the way, and go to the local bar and get really drunk sick. And so that, you know, the monks would never want to go out again. And I don't know if that's wise. But I never tried that, but certain kinds of desires I've sometimes fantasized. What would it be like for me to, if I really, really, like, you know, took this chocolate and just got more and more and just and more, you know. I can see I want the chocolate, but like, okay, Gil, you could, you know, now really kind of, slay, you know, there's 32 pounds of it. And maybe I'm peculiar, but when I think of it that way, it's, you know, then I think, oh, you know, I don't need that. It's okay. And I kind of like my something about the enchantment I have, the allure, the sensual allure of the chocolate. Like, it breaks the trance when I use my imagination that way. So then the third is the sloth and torpor, and I like to think of it sometimes as in terms of the strategies of how to. Unhelpful strategies of coping with personal challenges. Sloth and torpor are resistance and depression, resistance and giving up. And sometimes that's people's, you know, common strategy. They made some effort, they want to try to do something, things are difficult, and after a while they give up and they get depressed, or they kind of, this torpor sets in, or, you know, dullness sets in, or, you know, kind of get, you know, this kind of energy. Or a resistance. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to be involved. I'll keep that at bay. And there's when certain kind of resistance and certain kind of giving up happen, our energy drains out. Because sloth and torpor is not the same thing as being tired. You know, you're allowed to be. it's an ordinary thing to be tired, not have a lot of energy. But sloth and torpor happens when you've slept all that you need, plenty of sleep, and you have, you know, all kinds of things. You know, you're basically good and healthy and energetic, and then even so, you just kind of get so heavy and dull, and you can't make any effort. So, you know, I used to call it for myself. My seer's mind, because when I was a kid, I don't know how old I was, 8 or 9 years old, my mother would sometimes take me to Sears to buy clothes. And I hated it, the smell of it and clothes and the whole thing. And I was so tired. I'm so tired. I don't know if I can do this. I'm so tired. Oh, some of you have kids at home. You probably have seen the sloth and torpor set in. Oh, it's so hard. And then, but then, you know, at the end of the shopping trip, my mom would say, well, okay, now, so should we go and get some ice cream? You know, it was like, you know, I had lots of energy, and, you know, I woke up and things were just great, perky. And so, you know, the sloth and torpor was a strategy, was a response, was a reaction to not liking something and being aversive to it and being resistant to it and giving up. And so, seer's mind. So, you know, none of us, I think most adults don't want to admit that they're doing that. Well, I'm so tired. Oh, you know, this is so hard. I don't know if I can do this. But I think occasionally it works that way. And it's maybe not so conscious, but there can be a lot of challenges in life where, you know, we kind of have this, we get... And so part of meditation practice is not to give in to the impulses and feelings that come with sloth and torpor, with resistance and tiredness and giving up. So you have a strong feeling of wanting to give up and not make effort, but not to give in to it, but to hold the course, stay steady, be persistent with the practice. Keep going with the practice. Find some way or other to keep the effort going so you don't end up giving in. And it can be hard because sometimes you can fall asleep and you can fall over a little bit, and you know. But the important thing is to keep trying your best, making effort. And again, this amazing movement. I think it's a fantastic movement of turning 180 degrees around to really feel what's going on. And so the task in mindfulness would be, if you're really plagued by sloth and torpor, is to set yourself up to the task of becoming the world's leading expert in sloth and torpor. You know, if that's what's happening, I guess this is my task. I'm going to really study. I'm going to really study, not by analyzing or thinking about, but really go in there and really feel and explore. What does it feel like to be so dull, and, you know, to have the mind feel like a swamp, and the body to be getting all the energy drained out of it? What part of the body is it drained out of, and what does it feel like? The heaviness and the dullness and the feeling of lack and emptiness, and you know, what is it? And you know, so there's a lot of things to explore, and the very exploration, again, helps. It's a little harder with sloth and torpor, but begins the process of separation or freedom, a little bit, but also the very process of exploration helps us understand better what's going on, and see more clearly. So then there's restlessness and agitation. So sometimes the sloth and torpor, restlessness and agitation, are the results of frustrated desire, frustrated aversion. We have desires for something. We have the desire not to have something, to push something away, and we don't succeed. And so one strategy, we don't get what we want, is to give up. Another strategy is to get restless and agitated and run around in circles. And so the idea of the hindrances covering over, sloth, torpor, restlessness, agitation, restlessness and remorse, sometimes cover over a deeper frustration we have around not getting what we want. So it's useful sometimes to look at that. But the restlessness and agitation is a fascinating phenomenon, and especially for meditators. You know, I wish all of you get a chance someday to have a really good bout of sitting still in meditation and being restless, really restless. I mean, it's really something. I mean, like the power and the energy that can surge through your system, and the sense of, you know, the itch to bolt, you know, and you can hardly keep your, you know, arms still, and just all this power and energy. You didn't know there was so much. You can, you know, power the California energy grid, you know, all this. And what goes on in the mind when you're restless and agitated, and the spinning of thoughts and the jumping around of thoughts and the scatteredness it's quite something to sit there. I remember once having a lot of restlessness, and I had a great time because I imagined the restlessness was ping pong balls inside my body, and I just sat quietly and just watched the balls bounce around. And just that was fascinating to sit there and watch, you know, all this energy bouncing around, moving and everything. And in the process of doing that, by just watching and making space, like my body just be okay, just like my body was this very, very permissive receptacle for the ping pong balls, in the course of the 45 minutes, the balls quieted down. But it was from letting it be there, just studying it and letting it see what happened. But part of that is the commitment not to move. Not to move and let it kind of move through you. And it can be hard because sometimes restlessness and agitation comes with a certain kind of authority. It comes with sometimes the authority of the beliefs that go with it. You know, I have to move now. You know, and so... So the last of the hindrances is doubt. And it's commonly said that in terms of practice, Buddhist practice, meditation practice, doubt is the most dangerous to have, because doubt is the one that's most likely to get you to give the practice up, because of the doubts connected to the practice. And generally, doubt as a hindrance can happen in any activity in life at all. So doubt being a lack of confidence, a lack of faith, or lack of vacillation, has a lot to do with inability to decide, to be committed. It can be involved belief systems that I can't do it. I can't do it today. This is the wrong day. Or certainly there must be a better practice than this. Certainly must be some, you know. There's a lot of things people can doubt. And sometimes in the world of meditation, when people go, you know, meditate, the doubts there can go in many different directions. There can be one person can get caught, really caught, in doubting themselves. This is too hard. I can't do this. And when it's very powerful, that kind of doubt, it undermines the very attempt to do the practice. In some ways, it's kind of self-fulfilling. I can't do this practice, and if you're really caught by that, then you can't. And so it proves itself. But, you know, so the idea is try. Sometimes the doubt, the practice itself. This mindfulness stuff, I mean, that can't be serious. And what do these Buddhists know? And, you know, and just paying attention. You know, there's more important things in life. And there's all kinds of reasons to doubt it. Sometimes the doubt has to do with doubting the teachers. Those teachers don't know anything about what they're talking about. And, you know, they don't understand what it's really like for people. And they probably lived an isolated, you know, protected life. And they don't know anything about real life. And, you know, or they're just read too many books, and they're spouting from books, and, you know, what do they know? And so the doubt, and sometimes that, you know, when the doubt goes outwards, again, think of this as strategy. We're challenged, we have some difficulty, and so the response to that is to just spew out a lot of doubt. And doubt undermines our ability to make effort, undermines our ability to continue, keep it up, keep going. So as some of you know, one of the instructions I give for people who are caught in the grips of doubt is I tell them, if you really can't free yourself of the doubt so easily, then do it better. Just improve on it. And you can improve on it by adding more doubt to the mix, and doubt your doubt. because part of the power of doubt has to do with the authority we've invested in it. There's a certain kind of authority. It comes along with these strong beliefs, strong authority. Like, I can't do this. This is not possible. I don't think I can do it. And the more powerful that authority, that doubt is, the more it undermines us. But then doubt the doubt. Or don't believe the doubt. Or investigate the doubt. So again, this movement of 180 degrees, and look around, and rather than believe the doubt, rather than having doubt direct the show, go in and become curious about what it's like to have a mind that's filled with doubt. Well, how does that affect your body, your heart? What goes on in your mind? What are the thoughts? What are the beliefs? And what might it be covering over? In what way might doubt have arisen because I was frustrated, or because I felt uncomfortable, or because I felt there was some difficulty, and this is a response to difficulty? So there's always kind of mindfulness, it's a lot to do with, let's look more carefully, what's going on here? And the hope is that that movement, that practice of looking more carefully, being curious, being interested, turning around to looking at something, will begin showing you little movements of freedom that become bigger movements of freedom, of not being caught by something, being uncaught, being curious, being interested, rather than being caught. And the more interested you become, probably the less caught you'll be. And the less caught you are, my guess is that the more you'll appreciate the value of being uncaught. And that becomes a meaningful movement for you, meaningful direction for you to go in your life, is the movement direction of setting your heart, setting your mind free from things you're locked up in. So that was the talk I was going to give. So, well. We'll have to do something else another day. So thank you.